Good evening, I am Josh Beiser, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. Tonight, my guest is the co-founder of the studio Flipfly, who released what I describe as a very elevated take on the runner genre, which was Race the Sun. Please welcome to the podcast, Forrest Sanfilippo.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, Forrest, how's everything with you?
Doing really well. We're having nice, sunny, warm weather here in Wisconsin, and it's not very often that happens, so we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah, right now I'm in South Jersey, and it looks like we're about to have another storm. So
oh boy.
Very different weather here. All right. So to get things rolling for us, for people who haven't heard of Flipfly or Race the Sun before, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background with the game industry?
Sure. So Flipfly is made up primarily of two brothers. We're the founders and owners and programmers, designers, whatever else needs to be done type people in the company. Mm-hmm. And it started when my brother was working in the AAA industry. He was working for a subsidiary of Activision. Mm-hmm. And he'd been doing that for about 7 years. And I was doing freelance web and graphic design at the time, just kind of a freelancer working from home. And he was looking for something more creative, a better outlet for his game ideas. And he kind of approached me and said, "Hey, why don't we do this? I also am a kind of a hack musician, and I do that on the side." And he said, "You can do music and sound and visual stuff, and I can do the programming, and let's give it a shot." So that was back in 2011, I think, and we did it just kind of as our moonlighting job for a while. And then 3 years ago, we decided to jump in and go full time. We saved up a little bit of money, and mm-hmm. he quit his job, and I put out the not open sign, so to speak. And we tried a few different little things that kind of didn't seem like a projects that we really wanted to spend time on. And then we hit on Race the Sun in our prototyping phase, I guess, and we realized we had something special, so we decided to start up on that game full time. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of highs and lows, a lot of process to bring that game to market, but that's where it started.
Cool. Now, I, as you just said, Race the Sun came about during your prototyping phase. What attracted you guys to this project compared to the other ideas you had at the time?
Sure. So we actually had a list. We kind of decided to get formal with it at some point, and mm-hmm. we made a spreadsheet of all of our prototypes and all of our concepts, and we rated them based on how much we wanted to make them, how fun we thought they would be, whether anybody else might want to buy them, Race the Sun kept bubbling to the top. The prototype was produced in just a couple days. Actually, Aaron made that. I think he made a functional prototype in actually less than 24 hours, and it was just really fast and had a very simple avoidance mechanic, and so it was fun right off the bat. So it had that going for it, and then we kept having all these ideas for that game. We said, "Well, we could do this and we could do that," and it just felt like there was a lot of energy and a lot of fun, so that's how we ended up going that route.
Cool. Now, one thing that I found interesting or very cool about Flipfly is when I look at your About page, you talked about basically your studio's motto, that you want to make new, fun, honest, and clean games. And I find that interesting in how we've seen a lot of indie developers really go straight at the start of making, very extremely violent game or very bombastic games. And mm-hmm. Race the Sun was very much like a very relaxing experience, especially with the combination of the music and the art aesthetic that you went with it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so we, one of the things that we kind of relate to and we understand is that, getting into the indie industry is hard. It's hard to mm-hmm. get attention. It's hard to get noticed. And I think that maybe where some of those games come from is people say, "Well, if we do something extremely violent or extremely controversial, people will talk about it, and that'll mm-hmm. kind of be our in." But for us, we're both dads. We both grew up. Our gaming experience started with the Nintendo, the original Nintendo, Probably before that, actually, with some of the personal computers of the day, but that was when we really started getting into gaming, and it was something kids could enjoy. And we have kids now, and we want to play games with our kids, and so that just kind of became one of our values. We just don't want to go that route. Not to say that violence doesn't have its place in gaming or in storytelling. But for us, we don't want to have to hide the screen from our kids whenever they come in into our office, So.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be a challenge, especially when you have family all around you. Now, what's interesting about talking about how the industry has evolved is how much the skill level or types of games aimed at kids have really changed from back in our day. Mm-hmm. During the NES era, even games aimed at kids were very challenging titles. I'm talking like Ghosts and Goblins, Mario, Zelda, etc. And these days, when you look at games aimed at the kid market, they're very simple ideas. They're very much designed so that anyone can get through them. Stuff like the Traveler's Tales games, Lego, and etc. And with Race the Sun, it is a game that really anyone can play, and obviously that has to do with the runner mechanics. When you guys were coming up or continued to develop the game, was there any temptation to add more skill level or raise the difficulty curve of the game at all?
So yeah, with Race of Sun, trying to tune the difficulty of it, we definitely considered a lot of the old Nintendo games and some of the kind of arcade era games, and we wanted to get back into that. That idea of boy, this is incredibly difficult, but it's fun. And at the same time, we didn't want to burn people. We knew we couldn't really afford to burn people. This is our first game out of the blocks, and so. Fortunately, the type of game that Race the Sun is it allows us to kind of tune that difficulty and ramp it up. So hopefully there's a challenge there for everyone. Sooner or later, it gets just crazy difficult. So what we did was we just watched people play the game. And if, we felt like a pretty talented action gamer was just dying in the first region over and over and over again, maybe we would want to move some of that difficulty level back to region two. And so we kind of tuned for a while and ended up with a ramp that was actually easier than we initially thought it would be. But we find that I guess we try to hit a sweet spot. There are still players who come in and who've played like tons of Wipeout, and they just come in and just eviscerate the first five regions, no problem. But then we also said, we really need to make something for those players. So we made an apocalypse mode, which is like twice as fast. And so as you're playing along, once you upgrade your ship to like, I think it's like level 15 or something, we unlock that. And that also has its own leaderboard and everything. So people can basically, it's basically like the original, mode of the game, except just faster with a lot more stuff coming at you. So.
Okay. Now, since we are starting to talk more about Race the Sun, for people who haven't played the game yet, could you talk a little bit more about the basic gameplay or concept of the game?
Sure. So like you'd mentioned earlier, it's kind of a take on the runner genre. It's in full 3D and you're flying forward. So it's automatically the ship kind of never stops. You're always moving forward. And in front of you, you see the setting sun. And the deal is sort of, I guess there's not really a backstory, but you kind of understand that your ship is solar powered. So if the sun sets, your ship will die. So the sun kind of serves as your death timer. But if you catch speed boosts, you can actually kind of catch up to the sun, almost as if like if you're flying in an airplane across the U.S. And you fly towards the west, the sun never really sets. It's like that, except if you're going, you actually boost fast enough to actually lift the sun up in the sky a bit, and so that you can, in that way, you can kind of extend your day and keep racing. If you clip against objects, you'll slow down, and the sun will kind of get ahead of you a bit. And if you hit an object head on, you'll just die. You'll just immediately smash into pieces and have to start over again. So that's the core of the game. There are a lot of little things you kind of unlock along the way. You can unlock a jump. Pickup that allows you to kind of jump once for every pickup that you grab, and fly over some obstacles, and a few little things, but that's the heart of it.
Okay. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago regarding the art aesthetic of Raise a Stallion. It has like a very clean, very, I guess, soothing look to it. How did you guys settle on the art aesthetic for the game?
Well, that's cool. Soothing is. We started out kind of trying to do some a style that was a bit more literal, I guess you'd say. It was not photorealistic, but it was not not necessarily minimalist either. Mm-hmm. It wasn't coming together very good. Neither my brother or I are 3D artists by trade, and we kind of realized what we were trying to do was something that was not close to our skill set and not really close to our heart either. We like minimalism. We grew up with games like Star Fox, and we just love how, you know, the fact that they don't show you a lot of detail doesn't detract from the game. It actually lets your imagination go wild, you know, and you kind of see all the stuff that's not there. Mm-hmm. And so that became a big sort of inspiration for us. And we said, well, if Star Fox could do what it did at 10 frames per second, with, you know, 10 polygons on the screen, we can probably, you know, make that look pretty cool at 60 frames per second. So it kind of started as an idea. And then during our Kickstarter, things were not going very well, and we realized we hadn't kind of put our best foot forward at the visuals of the game. And we said, let's go for it. Let's try to reinvent the visuals of the game in this kind of minimalism style. And it really started clicking, and we liked it. With my graphic design background, I really connect with kind of like, you know, vector lines and sharp edges and things like that. They really work for me. So we liked it. People seemed to like it. And so we went all the way down that road. So
interesting. And also for the music, it has a very great rhythm to it. Did you compose music at all for it?
I did, yeah. This was kind of my first experience with composition beyond a few little things here and there. I've kind of do the singer-songwriter thing just on occasion. And so I kind of, you know, used to strumming a guitar. And for this game, I wanted to take a stab at the music. We didn't really have money to hire anybody better than me, so so let's give it a shot. So I fired up Logic and basically just started kind of playing the game and saying this is what it looks like. What would it sound like? So, and we knew we wanted the music to kind of match the aesthetic as closely as possible. So it ended up with kind of, yeah, somewhere between, you know, alternating between kind of frantic and relaxing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, I still don't know what to think of a lot of those tracks. They just kind of came together. It's somewhat experimental. But it seems to work for the game. I guess I'll say that.
Yeah. And you mentioned a few minutes ago regarding the progression model for the game and how your ship levels up over time. And I found this was a really great motivator to keep playing the game. I know you guys came with different, essentially, skill challenges relating to upgrading your ship. How did the progression model for the game come about?
Yeah, so we started adding these things to the game, and we realized pretty early on that we wanted some things to be unlockable. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't remember the exact point, but we realized that leveling up the player number rather than just being sort of an arbitrary number that you've accomplished could be the driver for unlocking things in the game, and it could kind of become a core mechanic. So at some point in there, we decided to bring those two things together, and we started kind of building a stats engine, you know, to say, well, how far have you traveled? How many points have you collected? How many times have you jumped or done a barrel roll? And that took a lot of iteration. I think that even if we had gone back and done it again, I think we would probably spend even more time building that out and trying to refine those. But what we ended up doing, we ended up with doing a three objectives are active at any time. Mm-hmm. And they're worth different amounts of points, so to speak, and you kind of work towards your next level. But what we ended up doing was each individual objective or task that you have to do is, once it's completed, it will be replaced by another objective. So you don't have to complete all three objectives simultaneously. And the idea there would be, like, if we ran into something, you know, where certain players just have a lot of trouble moving laterally, and you have to really move laterally to to do a barrel roll. And so we wanted it to be difficult, but not intensely frustrating, you know. And we've played games where, you know, the objectives feel arbitrarily frustrating. And for us, you know, I'm sure that the developer of the game, it wasn't frustrating for them. You know, they felt pretty good about it. But everybody plays differently. Everybody has different skills. And so that's kind of how it works. And you can actually go along and just kind of take the easiest one and try to just complete the easy ones and continue moving forward and upgrading. But eventually you'll have to take on a little bit more difficult challenge if you want to really get the unlocks. So,
Yeah, man, I find that very interesting about trying to develop challenges for different skill levels. I spoke with the developers of Action Henk a few months ago, which is a 2D sort of challenging, supposed to be a speedrunner type competition style game. And they talked about essentially the difficulty of setting up different challenge levels based on the same basic gameplay. And what he did for it was he basically played the game with different restrictions based on the difficulty. So if he was trying to make what would be considered the bronze or easiest challenge, he would play the game without using any advanced mechanics. He may slip up, stuff like that. And then when they're trying to design the super extreme difficulty, it's basically the developer going free reign with every trick in the book to challenge the player. Now, for you guys with the three-tier difficulty system, how did you decide what would be a one-point challenge or what would be a three-point challenge?
Sure. So one of the differentiators we make is that some of the challenges are actually persistent. So like earn 100,000 points, and you can actually do it over several runs. So it's something that's I guess you'd say grinding a bit, but it's also something that just happens naturally as you're playing the game. And so those are generally the 1 point challenges. Those all start out as kind of something that is a persistent thing, you know, collecting these, we call them tries. They're kind of like coins in the world or traveling a certain amount of distance. And so that kind of is just a small reward for, playing the game. And so those are more based on time. Like say, if you play the game for 5 minutes, how many, you know, how long will you have traveled and what would be the reward for that? And then the tier two challenges, those were kind of geared at, I guess, our skill level playing the game. Say, what are we comfortable with? The tier three challenges were kind of like, these ones are pretty difficult for us. Like this, these ones, if we sort of we have to really concentrate. You know, by this time we've played the game for hundreds of hours, and we still have to really concentrate to accomplish these tier three challenges. So, I think ideally we probably could have gotten some like game testers in and just had them play through the game over and over again at various skill levels. But as a small development team, it's really difficult to coordinate that kind of stuff. So yeah, like similar to the Action Henk guys, we had to kind of figure it out on our own and sort of figure out how to handicap ourselves or imagine other players. So, and again, it's always a trade-off. You know, some people find the challenges incredibly difficult. Some people tell us they completed them all in an hour and a half, and you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, you guys are so much better at our game than we are.
Some of my favorite ones on there are like the ones we have to complete a sector while only turning left or turning right. It's such a mind flip when you have to instinctively remember, oh, I can't turn to the right, I've got to keep going left, left, left.
Yeah, it messes with me too. And we like that. Like I said, if we had had unlimited amount of time to develop the game, we probably would have just kept working on that and made, you know, twice as many objectives and levels. But one of our things, you know, we actually eliminated a lot of objectives along the way that were just not fun. We said, if there's not some fun here, we're not going to do it. I'd love to have even more of that kind of stuff in there, you know, just to play the game in a different way.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I just wanted to clarify, both for my curiosity and for people listening, in terms of like the actual like sector design or level design, Race the Sun, is each daily play of the game procedurally generated, randomly generated, or something in between?
Yeah, so the way the game is assembled, we have grid pieces, so to speak. Each grid is like 64 by 64, and those grids are set. So those are hand designed. You know, I did most of the level design or arrangement, I should say, in the game, and I go in and place these objects in a 64 by 64 grid, and that just gets locked in and sort of stored in a bank of potential grids that can be spawned on any given day. And at the beginning of a 24-hour period, the game will, you know, grab the time, and then it will randomly pick 8 different patterns for this section of the game, and it'll arrange them and kind of lock them in for a 24-hour period. So it's purely random, but we do have specific rules that apply to each pattern. So if we say like, this pattern can spawn in region 1 and region 2, but no later. Or this pattern can only spawn in region 9, okay, and later. You know, so we kind of sorted our hand designed patterns based on their difficulty, and the system knows that. But then everything else from there out is random.
Okay. In terms of how far out you basically set the possible sectors to, what's like considered like the max difficulty or the max setting before it just goes, you know, on and on and on type deal?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to remember what our furthest out hand design pattern was, and I can't remember if it was region 10 or region 15, but I know that once you get past, you know, once you get to region 10, you'll definitely be seeing unique stuff out to that point. Then it'll start getting pretty repetitive because there's not a whole lot past that point, so yeah, that's one of those things as well where we kind of said, well, some of our players are going, you know, and getting 30 million points, and they are seeing a lot of repetition. But that's a very small amount of people. Most people have trouble getting to region 6 or 7, mm-hmm, even after playing for a while. So,
yeah. And yeah, very interesting about that with the clear difficulties. I know we have the Armageddon mode. And for that, does it work on the same principle that you develop the 64 by 64 pieces and then basically let the game pick and choose where they all go?
It does, yep. Yep, that's basically kind of the engine that we designed for the game. We wanted it, we tried just randomly creating the world, and it was frequently not interesting, you know. So how can we add some sort of hand design to the process and at the same time kind of have the system mix it up a bit, so.
Okay. Now, I noticed when you're playing the game, there's also those gateways that pop up that take you to another section. Are those sections, like, user-generated? Or are they, like, bonus levels, stuff like that?
Yeah, so if you're on Steam or playing the DRM-free version, those places are, as long as you're connected to the internet, it will actually load up a user-generated world. Those are hand-selected by us. We picked the ones that go into that rotation. Those are all created by our players using our level editor. Mm-hmm. If you're offline, it always goes to the same world, the Void world. But the other thing about those is the portal is the same for everyone, just like the leaderboards. So if you go off and you find yourself in the, you know, I think one is called House of Cards or something like that, or world, you know, if you find yourself in that, that's the same one that all of the other players that are online are playing as well. So,
okay. Now, with the Race Sun, in terms of, I guess, how far you guys wanted to go with the metagame progression, I believe it ends at level 25.
Mm-hmm.
Was there plans to extend that out further?
It's definitely something we've talked about. What we keep kind of coming back to is, we say, well, we could kind of extend that out in this game, or we could kind of think of another approach to it, and maybe do some kind of some more like dynamically generated challenges that would kind of be ever changing. And we haven't come up with a perfect solution yet. We know that we need to work on another game. at some point and not spend all of our time on Race the Sun. We would love to just keep iterating on it. But for right now, it's kind of, we've kind of just set it as it is and said, well, this is it. One of the things we added along, you know, after actually right around the time of our PlayStation launch, we added a level that gets unlocked when you complete level 25. And that's like a labyrinth of a slower game that kind of has more of a top-down view, and it actually has an end. So if you play through that, if you can get through like four regions of Labyrinthia, we call it, you'll actually complete it. And so we said, at least want to give players like a punctuation, you know, and say, well, at least I've leveled up my player and now I've completed Labyrinthia. I've kind of done all there is to do in a sense. Because we like, you know, it's always nice to have sort of that badge at the end of a game. But at the same time, we have a lot of players that say they do come back, you know, on a regular basis, just kind of as a breather between rounds of another game, or as a way to kind of get themselves focused for the day, which is really interesting. So
cool. And another part of Race the Sun, I'm glad you mentioned the Labyrinthian mode, because I was about to bring that up too. So in terms of future development, I know we're going to talk briefly about your guys' next game in a few minutes. In terms of Race the Sun, though, are you guys planning any new content down the line?
Yeah, possibly. Actually, we haven't announced anything yet, but we are actually kind of working on something right now that is kind of coming together. So hopefully, I don't want to spill the beans on it too soon. I think this is actually going to be our first foray into DLC. We realized that, you know, that there was a possibility here of doing kind of like other small little ideas into the game, and offering them up as paid DLC for players, and see if you know, we would love for Race the Sun to kind of fund continued development, you know, where we'd like, we have these other ideas for it and things, and DLC might be a way that we could kind of give ourselves a good reason to keep working on the game, so to speak. And so this will be our first foray into DLC. So we're working on that. And then the other thing we're working on is virtual reality. So Race the Sun, actually we have a beta on Steam right now that supports the Oculus Rift. And we are definitely actively working on virtual reality support for the game. So that's the other thing we're working on with Race the Sun.
Cool. The Rift is definitely becoming a very interesting topic for a lot of developers. I've spoken to a few people who are very interested in it. For you guys at FlipFly, what do you think about the Rift and VR and along those lines?
Well, you know, I guess we're old enough to have gone through kind of the VR boom and bust of the 90s, where it was the next big thing until it wasn't. And part of me wants to be skeptical and say, oh, you know, it might come and go. It might be 3D TVs and nobody will really want to do it. But then when I experience the games that and the experiences that are being made for VR, it kind of sets you in a different mindset. You say, wow, you know, you start to see potential. And then the fact that the technology is not holding things back very much anymore. There's still technological limitations, but nothing like they were facing in the 90s when they were trying to develop VR. You know, most of the big problems have been solved. And so I get very excited about it. I think that it's hard for me to imagine that it will be widely adopted in the short term. But it's also hard to imagine that by the time, you know, things like the Oculus and Sony Morpheus and the, you know, Steam's project they're doing with HTC, like, it's hard to imagine that by the time those products hit their third and fourth iteration that they won't be so awesome that people will just have to kind of take notice, you know. You know, you think about these things. Well, it's just people would spend, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 on a 4K TV to put in their living room. Well, what if you could spend, you know, $400 on a headset and have a movie theater in your, you know, and you could sit on the beach and have a, you know, a movie projected over the ocean or whatever it would happen to be, you know. And I honestly think, you know, the VR experiences in the next, you know, I guess 3 to 5 years are going to be so good that it would be hard not to see that as an option for people, you know.
Yeah. And VR is definitely one of those polarizing topics for some people. I've spoken to developers in the past who aren't really seeing it as the future. And then I have a few developers who are just enthusiastic, enthusiastic about it. And they really do see both the practical applications and really what it can mean for both the future of game development and just the future of technology in general. Mm-hmm. I spoke with Robin on that. I believe he did the game that's all sound about being in the...
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So Robin is just a huge enthusiast for it. Well, I'm definitely more on the apprehensive side, mainly because I really haven't had a chance to look at the Rift yet. Mm-hmm. I have a friend. He's the site designer for Game Wisdom, and he is just, you know, full-on support for the Rift. He donated to, like, the original Kickstarter. I think he has the DK2 right now, mm-hmm. where he's going to get, and he just swears by it. But yeah, talking more about the VR, that's, you know, a whole other topic. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when the Rift finally hits the general market and see how consumers respond to it.
Yeah, yeah, it will be really interesting. And I, you know, I there will definitely be people who will buy the Rift. I have no doubt about that. There'll be a large amount of people, but there'll still be, my guess is, you know, I guess the big question is how big will that group be? You know, there are people right now who build holodecks with projectors and you know, and things just so they can play one game, you know. And so there will definitely be people who are willing to spend even a lot more than it will cost when it hits the market for a decent VR experience. But one of the big questions is, yeah, how big will that market be? And I think one of the things right now is, so you look at, you know, you look at what's kind of happened, you know, with the transition to mobile, you know, and we've seen mobile devices kind of explode. And you know, I think everybody has said, you know, had a major voice in the industry say PC gaming is dead, you know, and then 2 years later it's grown, and, you know, then somebody else says PC gaming is dead, you know. And I think with these transitions, there will always kind of be a long tail of the old technology. And part of that is because, you know, when you talk about kind of the PC format, like, it took a while to sort of find the ideal use of that technology. You know, how can, you know, you think you talk about games, you know, that use the mouse and the keyboard, and some of them are so finely tuned and so refined. It's going to take a long time for VR to catch up to that. You know, the original experiences, that as cool as they are at the moment, are going to feel so clunky 10 years down the road. And I think that's one of the things that developers, you know, if you kind of put your business hat on and a developer, you know, you would say, well, look, you know, the likelihood of this having a huge market in the short term and me betting the farm on a VR game is, you know, that's kind of not smart. Mm-hmm. But then if you put your kind of your gamer hat on and say, oh my gosh, if I could play this game in VR, it would be my ultimate experience, you know. Mm-hmm. So, if someone asked me, like, I'm starting out as an indie, should I get into VR? Is it the next big thing? I'd say, well, you know, how often do you visit Vegas? Like, it's, you know, you're talking about a big risk there. But that said, a lot of people missed the iPhone, you know. There are a lot of developers that could be multimillionaires right now if they'd simply ported one of their games to the iPhone in its first or second generation, because the market got so big and there were so many new gamers that wanted good content. All they would have had to do was spend a couple months porting a game and they could have been set, you know? Yeah. And so people miss the gold rush. And I think there are a lot of developers now in this generation who don't want to miss the next one. And so that's part of the reason why you see a lot of people jumping at VR, or at least devoting some of their time to it.
All right. I think with that, we'll move on to talk some about some more general industry topics. Before we go, are there any other parts about Race the Sun, not specifically talking about the pricing, which is actually going to be a next topic, but in terms of the design or development of it that I miss?
Well, I think you hit the heart of it there. You know, we had a long, difficult process bringing the game to market. We were kind of, you know, started with nothing as far as connections, and so we didn't have access to Steam. We went through Steam Greenlight. Not sure, we may have set a record for how long a game has sat on Steam Greenlight. We did a Kickstarter. We tried a lot of different things, and we learned a lot along the way. And we're just really, you know, grateful and thankful to be where we're at. You know, to be able to do this full time and continue development on Race the Sun and make a new game. So
cool. So with that, I do want to talk a little bit more about some general topics. And I guess the first one would be what we were just starting to talk about, which is the Kickstarter or the gold rush that we've been seeing a lot in some of the future trends of the industry. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you mentioned Race the Sun was on Kickstarter. And as a developer, or especially as someone who got into the game industry very recently, you said you guys started in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about Kickstarter and crowdfunding as a model in general?
Well, it's one of those models that I think it needs a lot of people involved to work. Mm-hmm. It needs a lot of diverse people involved for it to work. If you're going to support, if the point of it is to support projects that wouldn't otherwise get supported, then you need to have those niche audiences there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's still in some ways in the experimental phase, even though we've kind of seen an explosion and then maybe a bit of a decline in games being funded through Kickstarter. It's still kind of a format that needs to be proven. I will say that I love it. I think that crowdfunding, as long as it's kind of out in the open, you know, and I think Kickstarter has done a really good job of even improving their platform. So a lot more things are spelled out. Mm-hmm. There's accountability on project, developers, game makers to deliver something, as well as some pretty notable failures. And I think that gives people pause, which it should. You know, if you're putting money in on an unfinished project, that's a risky proposition. So I think that it's kind of in its teenage years right now. It still hasn't quite matured. That's my guess. I'm not sure that it will become a dominant structure. I don't know that every game is going to pass through some form of crowdfunding to come to market. But it's still something that I hope does become a prominent and healthy way for people to get their projects funded, because it does, and especially for us, like we connected with so many players who I don't think ever would have heard about our game, because we had no way to make noise about our game. You know, we didn't have $250,000 to go spend on advertisement. So Kickstarter really helped raise the profile of our game and find people who truly believed in the concept and really wanted to bring it to life. And those people have continued to, you know, kind of be big supporters of us and our game. And we've, you know, kind of considered them friends ever since the Kickstarter. And so it's something that I'd love to see grow and expand and continue going.
Okay. Now, when did Race the Sun actually go on Kickstarter?
Oh, good question. I should actually look that up. It was before. Let's see. Look at the date here. So it was in March of 2013, I believe, was the launch of it. We had basically only been developing the game for I think about 5 months, but 4 or 5 months by the time we launched our Kickstarter. So it was pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
And when we launched the Kickstarter, all we really had was this kind of very alpha footage of the game. And it wasn't a great sort of first step, I guess, to put the game out there. And we actually did a ton of development during the Kickstarter and did a lot of radical changes to the game to kind of show what we were trying to do. And so really, if we had had some more funding, we probably could have waited a few months and done it a proper Kickstarter. But getting the game out there in front of people and getting people's honest gut level reactions was huge in the development. I don't know that the game would be what it is today without putting it in front of people and kind of getting that feedback. So, it was hard. We almost didn't make it. We were literally hours from the end of the campaign when we crossed the finish line and actually made the money. And we weren't one of those Kickstarters that was like, just like we needed a little bit of extra cash. Like we were relying on that to finish the game. And like, if we didn't make it, we would have had to, go back to our regular jobs and probably been developing the game for the next 2 years, So.
And I like what you just said for us regarding getting the feedback from the users during the development, because that's what we hear similarly from the early access space these days, with developers using that to basically gauge player impressions and basically get a lot of good feedback on how the game's coming together during that very critical state where the game is very much in flux.
Yeah, and we've never done like early access, but it seems that developing kind of in front of players is really a really important thing, and even beyond sort of like player testing, which every big studio does. Actually, developing the game in front of people can have a really deep impact on the experience, and I think who the game can reach, because you're hearing voices you wouldn't hear in any other context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, with your Kickstarter for Race of Sun, for any developers listening to this who are also considering the platform, are there any things that you would have done differently, or the old hindsight is 2020 type thing with the campaign?
Oh yeah, definitely. So I probably couldn't list them all here. We made a lot of mistakes, but I guess the first and biggest thing to remember is it's all about the game. You've got to have a concept that you love. And that other people, other people will love, and you can't know that if you just kind of keep it to yourself and just pop it out on Kickstarter one day and hope that it'll get featured and get write-ups and all that. It usually doesn't work that way. Usually you've got to kind of bring a bit of an audience with you, some people that are already kind of ready to champion your game and your concept. So there are some great formats for that, like things like Indie Game Database and places where you can have conversations about your game and get started. You can put early versions of your game out on Kongregate, which that's kind of changing now, but just because of some of the browser support. But you can actually put like a Unity web build out on Kongregate, and so I would definitely say like don't make Kickstarter the first outing of your game. Bring it to parties. Get people in front of it and see what they have to say. But also like get your game to a point where at least you can show a couple minutes of footage of the game that is pretty much what you want it to be. Like if you can convey the game experience that you want players to have with footage of the game, and you got 1 or 2 minutes of that, I think you'll have a pretty good idea. Like if you just got an idea and a concept, you can't get kickstarted for an idea unless it's like a world changing idea. Like you have to have something that you can show people visually if you want to have any kind of decent chance. There are outliers. There are exceptions to the rule, but I would say it's all first and foremost, it's all about the game.
Cool. Now, I guess my last question regarding Kickstarter then, and this is one I like to ask all of our developers who come on, is what do you think about how viable the platform will remain? Now, obviously, it's gone through a lot of big changes. We've had a lot of big wins and a lot of big losses over the last 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. For you, Forrest, in your opinion, do you think that Kickstarter will remain a viable option for game development in the future?
I think so. I think it's likely, just like everything, the market will mature. I think it's likely that you'll see more success in kind of the mid to large tier projects. Maybe companies that have made 3 or 4 games getting on there and kickstarting a bigger project. And part of that is just going to kind of be, it's going to shake out as things will over time, and I don't know that for sure. But I have a tendency that to think that there'll be a raised expectation for your average Kickstarter backer to say the expectation of quality right from the outset is going to be pretty high. Although there may be other markets, you know, that kind of come up behind Kickstarter and fill that gap. And maybe in a little bit different way, you know, crowdfunding is, it's not a new concept, but the internet is a huge twist on the crowdfunding thing that leaves a lot of, open-ended questions. And I think that we may see more interesting ways to crowdfund, that haven't even been considered yet. And it wouldn't surprise me if we don't see another startup, you know, pop onto the scene with a new model, you know, we've talked about even like, you know, like a co-investment model, you know, where people might actually be able to kind of invest in the game project and see proceeds from the sales of the game or something like that. You know, like there are lots of things that haven't really been tried in a big way. So I do think that it has staying power. I think Kickstarter will be around for a long time, and crowdfunding will be around for a long time. But I'm sure that it won't look like it did, you know, a couple of years ago, where you see a little, you know, a little indie developer making their first game, putting some pixel art up on a page, and you know, getting $100,000, which was 10 times what they were asking. You know, like I doubt we'll see that. But that's not all bad. You know, sometimes those filters that kind of society or markets put in place, they do kind of protect people as well. So although we do want to see creative things come to market, a little bit of barrier to entry isn't always a bad thing.
All right. Now, moving on, I know a few minutes ago we talked briefly about how Racist Sun was on Steam's Greenlight project for a very long time, and that actually takes me to the next topic I want to discuss with you, Forrest, and that was the challenges of pitching Racist Sun to the market. So, with Racist Sun, I know a few years ago you guys wrote a post about some of the challenges of getting Racist Sun noticed by consumers. I know one of the first things that a lot of people were talking about was the initial price of the game, which I believe when the game was released, it was at $10, was that it?
Yeah, yep.
And I know even in my review of the game, I also brought that up because one of the challenges of the runner genre, especially the runner genre in particular, is just how many games are there in that genre. The mobile market is flooded with them. We see a lot even on like Facebook and social games. And part of the challenge really is making your particular game stand out from all those ones, especially the ones that are, you know, free to play. For you guys, what was like some of the thoughts that were running through your head when you were trying to pitch the game or try to get people to essentially pay for this game where there's dozens, if not hundreds, of clones out there?
Yeah, that was really difficult. And one of the things we realized we had done, which was a huge mistake, was we used the term "endless runner" in our marketing, and because there are so many, and you know, Flappy Bird and Cannibalt, you know, are kind of like very prominent. And what was the other one?
Jetpack something.
Yeah, Jetpack Joyride by Half Brick, and so there were some really big successes on mobile at the time. And it's not a new genre. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but it was kind of like getting revived and having this comeback. And so everybody was trying to make an endless runner, you know, and it's a good model for a small indie because you can reuse a lot of content. You can make a lot of gameplay without a lot of assets. So if you're just a programmer who doesn't have, you know, a lot of resources as far as artists, you know, you could actually produce a pretty big feeling game without a lot of art. So, you know, there's a lot of good reasons why people were jumping into it, but everybody was trying it at once. And so people, the press and everybody was just kind of like burning out, you know, they didn't want to hear about another endless runner. It's fine, you know, that it does share mechanics with an endless runner, and as you discover that when you play it. But sort of the heart of the game really is more about speed, you know, and you kind of have to play it to see what we're talking about. You know, you have to get a sense of that speed and that experience. And so a lot of people just shut us down, and we didn't make any inroads into a lot of press outlets, I believe, because of that endless runner term. So that was a huge mistake. Another mistake we made was that we, we didn't have our kind of our aesthetic and our visuals kind of nailed down before we made a lot of our press materials. And so we, when we were trying to get write-ups and things like that, we were working on it. Not that it's bad to try to get people to notice you. It's just that we were talking about this game, and when people looked at our screenshots, what they saw was just very alpha, very kind of rough looking footage. It felt very much, you know, very amateurish, and they have no way of knowing, since this is our first game, that this is going to look any different. You know, that this, you know, how would a person looking at this guess that it's going to look much more polished and much more finished? Actually for the future game we're working on, the game we're working on right now, that's going to be our kind of our next big release, is we haven't released any screenshots of it at all. We had an artist, Tim Reynolds, do kind of like a poster for it. And it's a good approximation of what the art looks like and where it will be. But rather than putting something out there with kind of like our hacky, you know, development animations and kind of, you know, broken shadows or whatever else happens in that process of developing a game, and so why don't we just kind of put out our, you know, our ideal version of what we want the game to look like. And then, you know, when we're ready to share video and gameplay and things like that, people can judge for themselves, you know, but then what they're looking at is something that's very close to the product that they'll be buying or reviewing. So we're trying a different approach this time around.
Yeah, and getting that first, your best foot forward, I think is becoming more and more important for the indie space, because there's just so many developers striking out these days that you're no longer, you know, that one unique snowflake in the crowd anymore. You really do need to show why your game is so unique, so big, etc. And I know you mentioned when we're talking about Kickstarter, about how the days of someone putting, like, super basic footage of an indie game and getting $200,000-$300,000 is pretty much gone. You really do need to approach Kickstarter and even just showing your game as a major serious campaign.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, you can usually tell if you've got, you know, where you're at. If you've done it once before, I think you've got a sense of how people are reacting and responding to your visuals. And that if you've never gone through the process, it's really hard to know, you know, because your friends and your family all say, that looks amazing, you know, and that doesn't really tell you anything. So, you know, we've learned, Greenlight actually has this kind of, you know, really, really helpful feature in that there's a lot of sort of core gamers on there that just don't care about you at all. And that's actually really helpful, you know, because this is your potential market. So if you put something up on Greenlight and you're just getting all kinds of hatred, and I'm not talking about the occasional, you know, like negative comment, like we put our game on Greenlight and it was like, we got a few positives and just a lot of, oh my gosh, what are, you know, no more of this garbage on Greenlight. And, you know, and we realized, you know, that we were, that was kind of the big wake up call, that we were kind of, there was a gap between what we wanted the game to be and what we were actually showing people visually. And, you know, and then that kind of forced us back to the drawing board in a really good way. And Reddit is another one, you know, like the gaming threads in Reddit. Throw some screenshots up there, you know. If you throw something on Reddit and it just kind of like explodes visually, well, you're probably onto something, you know, go with that. You know, not to say if you get a couple jerks on there that are just don't like your style, that's okay. You know, don't be too disheartened. You got to kind of learn to filter. But you will definitely, in this market, you definitely have to have strong visuals, and you have to put that out there in a compelling way if you want to have a chance. So
okay. Now, speaking about Steam Greenlight, we talked about how the game was up there for so long. I know you guys actually participate in the Not on Steam bundle promotion a few years ago, and that's how I found Race of Sun to begin with. How did that whole Not on Steam bundle sort of come about?
Yeah, so we had been on Greenlight forever, and we said, you know, by this time the game was in good shape. You know, we were really happy with it. We really felt like we had something special. But we had actually released the game on our website because we weren't on Steam, and we didn't have any way to make noise about it. You know, we're not releasing on a console. We're not on Steam. We don't have this kind of built-in audience from a previous game. And we felt like the game was really worthwhile. But we just had this kind of capped potential because we weren't on Steam, and we realized that there were a lot of other people in the same boat as us, you know, other developers who were kind of stuck on Steam. And so we finally kind of started breaking through. We released the game. We didn't make much money on our website. And it was starting to become evident that we would be greenlit eventually. And actually, this was one of Aaron's ideas. You know, it was just a great, you know, brilliant idea on his part. I say, well, why don't we do a sale? You know, and we can just have other people who are in the same boat as us, you know, get together and we'll make a website. And I'm like, okay, well, I can make websites. You know, we could do this. And we just literally just stopped everything and built a website. And we made it so that it would randomly sort the game. So whenever you load, every time you loaded up the website, you'd see another random assortment of screenshots. And we kind of put the call out to some people that we knew and out on Twitter. People just started flooding in. You know, there were even more than we thought. You know, that would just say, "Oh yeah, put us on your site," and we got people who said, but I don't have a mechanism for selling my game yet. You know, like, we're like, okay, here's the guys at Humble. They'll get you set up with a widget. The Humble widget was still pretty early. They hadn't, like, it was kind of in a beta release of the alpha of the Humble widget. And so we got a bunch of people signed up with Humble, and it all kind of came together, and then it just sort of went nuts. You know, it was bigger than we really even thought it would get. Kind of peaked out, I think, when we got a write up on I think Forbes did a small blog post about us, and Notch retweeted someone who had sent him a link and crashed our website, and then people kind of came out of the woodwork to help, and like we had some website experts helping us figure out how to keep that from happening, and it was great. It just felt like the indie community at its best, you know. Kind of comically, the first day that we launched the sale, we got an email from Steam letting us know that we were greenlit, and actually several of the games that were in the sale got greenlit that round, and several more over the coming months. And we'd like to think that the sale had something to do with some of those, that they kind of raised the noise a bit. So
yeah, and I mean, that's a really interesting thing about Steam is that it has really become such a huge portion for PC and indie game development. And for the developers who get on it, it can be fantastic, but getting that foot in the door can be such a major pain in the ass. I know a few developers who I've spoken to who've also had nothing but trouble getting onto the platform.
Yeah, it can be hard. You know, what I tell people is, you know, it's not perfect. Like, Greenlight is broken. Obviously, we kind of had a rough experience on Greenlight. We don't have hard feelings over it. We don't hold it against Steam, because we kind of, I guess we kind of understand what they're trying to do, and it's not quite there. But at the same time, as an indie, what we've learned is that the work that you will do to get your game on Greenlight, to promote it, to, you know, create promotional materials and talk to the press and do these various things, like, it's really hard and it's not fun, but it's the kind of thing that you're going to have to do if you're going to make it as an indie. Like, if you want to work for a company and make their thing and have their advertising department, right? I mean, they can, you know, a AAA can put lipstick on a pig, you know, and sell it. That's fine, right? They do it all the time, but you can't do that as an indie. You're going to have to figure out how to do this and how to make your game appealing. Or maybe just decide that, you know, doing games as a hobby is for you, you know? I mean, that's fine. Like, you know, art games are a thing, and that's a really good thing. We need people who are willing to make games that have no market potential at all, you know, that just send a message. And that's fine. But if you're going to try to make money at making games, you're going to be doing this. You're going to be, you know, kind of fighting this uphill battle, and it's not always fair. But it's the real world. And so Steam kind of mimics the real world in that way. And Steam Greenlight does. And as hard as that is, I think it's imperfect, but it's okay, you know?
Yeah. And this was a question that I wanted to ask you a few minutes ago regarding talking about the pricing of Race to Sun. And I just want to ask you, What was the decision behind pricing the game at $10? And this is just a overall question that we've been seeing a lot of developers these days struggle with trying to decide what is the right, you know, price per value for their game. Some developers find that even charging, you know, $20-$30 is too much, while others see the $5 to $10 as more acceptable. And this leads into a greater discussion on game devaluation, but that's, you know, another hour, 2 hour conversation easily.
Yeah. Well, yeah, just kind of the nod to game devaluation there. That's one of the issues is that, you know, the pricing of a game isn't determined by how much time you spent working on it. Mm-hmm. It's not determined by how many hours you give to the game player either. It's determined by what the market will bear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to step away from your game for a moment and say, well, what can I sell this for? Mm-hmm. For us, you know, we asked that question, what can I sell this for? And then secondly, what will people be happy with? You know, if I sell this for X amount of dollars and then a player plays this game, will they be happy having spent that money? Mm-hmm. And so those are somewhat nebulous, but those are the questions that we asked. And $10 just, you know, again, we don't have a marketing department. We can't do market research. Mm-hmm. So $10 seemed like a good value for what we have. And it also gave us, you know, we felt like the game was, it wasn't a $5 game. You know, we felt like it was a bigger experience, even though it may not initially appear so. You know, when you start playing, you start getting into it, you realize, oh, wow, there's actually, you know, there actually is, you know, a leveling system here. There's some unlocks and different game modes. And the game we ship with today has two additional game modes that get unlocked on top of the core one. And we just feel like it's a good value. So it's hard. It is nebulous. One of the good rules of thumb, though, is you can never go up. You can always go down, mm-hmm. but you can never go up. You can't release at $10 and then have a sale and sell it for $15. It doesn't work that way. So generally, we encourage people to be honest, be realistic, but start at the higher end of what you feel your game is worth. Don't sell yourself short. Mm-hmm. If you feel like everybody's saying the game is too expensive, but they're still buying it, then, you know, people are speaking with their pocketbooks, right?
Yeah.
But if they're saying it's too expensive and they're not buying it, then it might be time to reevaluate your price point. So.
Yeah, definitely. And we're also seeing issues, not to get too far into it, but there's also the big debate on monetizing mods and mm-hmm. trying to put a price tag on, you know, someone's a new sword or enhanced weather effects.
Yeah.
And that is something that at this time of this podcast is still very much a hotly debated issue. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where the chips are going to fall when everything is all said and done on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a whole new thing, right? I mean, I guess mods have been, you know, you could sell mods. It wasn't something that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, mods were based on another game engine and there wasn't a market for them. You know, you couldn't really like, other than creating a new, you know, a kind of a new executable based on a mod, there wasn't really a way to bring, you know, this monetization into play. Mm-hmm. And Steam has figured out a way, and really they're the only people who could, you know. For me, you know, and really Aaron, I know this because he just wrote a big blog post about it. But we're all for it, you know. For us, it seems like the right direction, that's not to say that community isn't important or people just making games for the love of games isn't a good thing. That's a great thing, and I believe firmly that will continue. Just because people can sell their mods doesn't mean that they will. Mm-hmm. Steam is also going to support pay what you want. So that's kind of neat. You know, we have sort of the first foray into this market has an option to pay what you, as where, you know, or a developer can list their mod as pay what you want, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But I also believe that this will allow a lot more people to get into modding and to make higher quality content. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, And I also think it's very, I was chatting with the guys at the company today, and I said, you know, something that I believe is going to happen is you're going to have developers of the games, you know, who are on the teams that made, you know, say Skyrim or whatever a game it happens to be, who are going to start making mods.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some of these mods will even be, you know, content that just didn't make the cut, you know, for the original game. And I think that now that there's a way to monetize that, you'll see studios actually giving their blessing to using that content. So I think this is actually going to probably produce a lot more high quality content, and open up the market even more. I don't think it's going to have a restricting factor at all. I think that, you know, people will continue to make free mods, and you'll probably see actually a lot more free mods, or maybe people make a really high quality episode one mod, and then they sell the second one or whatever it happens to be for a given game. So generally, I think it's really positive. There are going to be problems. There are always problems. You know, Steam, or Valve will have to work through those as they come. They'll work it out for the rest of the industry, and then then everybody else can just copy their storefront. So.
Yeah, and I mean, I like the idea of it. I think, as you said, Forrest, it's going to open up the doors to higher echelons of modding, but I do think there are some issues with how it's set up right now. But by the time this podcast goes up, or actually we have a podcast dedicated to this topic, should be already out. So I'm cool. Going to save my entire spiel for that one.
I'll have to check it out. That's cool.
Okay, and it's been really great chatting with you, Forrest, today, but I know we could easily sit here for another hour or so, but
totally.
I figure we can probably start talking about our final topic for the cast, and that is what's next for FlipFly. Now, we mentioned already that you guys are still working on Race of Sun. You have more ideas for that.
Mm-hmm.
But before the cast, you also mentioned that your hard work at a new project. And I was hoping you could give us a little teaser for that for the people listening.
Yeah, definitely. So this new project actually started as a Ludum Dare game that Aaron made. It was really straightforward, kind of a hexagon puzzle game where you're kind of arranging water and land in a hexagon grid and trying to grow plants. And the game is it bears little resemblance to the original Ludum Dare game, but the concept is still there. And that's it. It's going to be a kind of single screen puzzle game based on a hexagon grid where you're trying to grow plants over a season. And in some ways we're taking what we learned with Race the Sun and then going a totally different direction. it's going to be very relaxing. We're shooting for a super chill, relaxing environment where you can kind of take your time. Right now it's the structure of it is turn-based, and there's no timer, no way to die, you know. it's hard to describe game mechanics, you know, verbally, there'll be some creative aspects to it as well. So what you're doing on the board isn't just producing points or you know, trying to complete a difficult puzzle. You're also kind of creating something, and probably can't describe it any better than that. But
okay, so what's like the general gameplay like? What is the player going to be doing in Hex Garden?
Yeah, so if you start out a game, generally what you'll see is this hexagonal garden that's filled with small hexagon shapes, and you might see part of your garden that's grass, part of it that's a rocky area, and you'll see water points, and you can move the water throughout the garden by kind of dragging it into adjacent hexagon pieces, and you can chop down the grass, you can prepare the soil by chopping down the grass and getting rocks out of the way, also moving rocks, and then you can plant that soil, and you have to water it, and it begins to grow. So you're trying to build this lush garden in the time that you have, trying to use the space efficiently and do things in a small amount of moves. So there's sort of a concentration element, you know, where you're kind of thinking things through and figuring out the best place to put things. And then as you kind of develop your garden, you'll start running into trouble. So rabbits may pop up and try to eat your plants, and you can, there are rocks that you can move around and defend your garden from the rabbits, and just lots of other little elements that we've got in mind that will make things interesting. But the mechanics itself, like how the hexagons work and the various rules about them, are kind of hard to convey, and they're still in process. But we do know kind of the basics at this point. We have a playable that we put out at PAX East, and it just took about 5 minutes to play through, and people really got into it. You know, it seemed like people were getting they were being somewhat relaxed, and they were thinking and contemplating, and they were kind of creating something that seemed to look pretty cool. So and that those were our goals, you know, for the player experience. We really wanted those things, so we're feeling really good about it. But yeah, we're still in the thick of development. We probably won't even be showing any gameplay videos or anything like that until maybe mid or late summer. So
cool. Now, in terms of the general gameplay, as we mentioned with Race the Sun, it was a game that was aimed pretty much for all skill levels, all age groups. Mm-hmm. Are you aiming for the same thing with Hex Garden?
Yeah, I think so. Like we felt like one of the things we learned with Race the Sun was that if we can design a game that is playable by a gamer at sort of just starting out, or someone who maybe is just coming to the genre. Not imagine someone who plays strategy games on a hex grid all the time, but somebody who maybe is, you know, maybe the extent of their puzzle playing is, you know, Tetris or something. So, we want them to be able to figure it out. And that was one of the things we actually got to test with kids, and have some kids come and play the game. And that was pretty awesome, because the kids actually they figured things out even sooner than sort of gamers with sort of their predefined notions. The kids came in, they're like, oh, this is a rock. What can I do with the rock? You know, and I move it around. Oh, I can drop the rock into the water. And that makes something else if I combine these two things, you know, and it worked really well. And then at the same time, we've got some players who are like really hardcore puzzle gamers and strategy gamers and stuff. And so we're testing sort of the high level strategy with them, you know, say, is this enough meat for you? You know, are you digging in enough? And we love kind of those games that sort of skirt the edges of genres, you know? Triple Town for mobile is probably a good example of that, you know, where it's like, It has this kind of cartoony style, and you start out and it's kind of simple initially. You know, like, oh, I combine, you know, three bushes and I make a tree and I can do it. But once you get into it, like, there's this high level strategy that's really, really, really difficult. I mean, you are like, your brain is working by the time you get up into, you know, the higher levels of scoring and stuff. And that's just a brilliant design by Dan Cook. And so that's kind of like the lofty goal, I guess, that we have, is to kind of be one of those games that reaches everyone in that way.
Cool. Now, in terms of like advancement or progression, do you have any progression mechanics like in Race the Sun?
There will be. They're still very much in flux, but most likely what we're going to have is actually a kind of a dynamic progression, something that can kind of be done endlessly. Mm-hmm. So in Race the Sun, you have sort of this fixed 25 levels. We don't want to put a limit like that. So we're still working that out. Again, this is kind of a lofty goal to say, can we make kind of objectives for the player that are fun, but also go on and on forever? You know, so they're somewhat kind of procedural in the way that they're generated, or kind of the way that they play out in each individual game is different enough that they are interesting, no matter which objective you get. It kind of plays out a little bit differently. So, pretty lofty goal. We've got some that end of it is still mostly just ideas at this point. So, we'll be prototyping those. We'll see how it goes. Maybe in the end, we'll discover that there's just not a better way. You know, maybe we just need hand designed objectives, and maybe that's just how you do it. But we'll see.
Yeah, in terms of like having like a open-ended type puzzle experience or open type experience, two examples that I really enjoyed were like the games like Ruse and Viva Pinata from a few years ago by Rareware.
Yeah, yeah.
and I really enjoyed them. What they did was, as you play the game and complete more content or get higher accomplishments, this will in turn raise your profile level, your character level, etc. And then each level you go up basically unlocks something new, or unlocks some new feature or content or bonus that then gets applied to subsequent games. Like with Viva Pinata, every time you level up, maybe unlocks a new character who can show up, or a new tool in your inventory, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And those types of motivation or progression models, I think, really work in terms of that, you know, that just one more level or just one more turn. It's that classic Sid Meier experience about with Civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And actually, Viva Pinata has come up several times in conversations, and I never had a 360, as I wasn't exposed to that. So I gotta get my hands on that so I can play that game. But
yeah, I mean, I sold my 360 a few months ago, but I kept that game because if I do have to get another one, I want to make sure I saw that game because it's one of my favorites, along with like Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts, which is just cool. A complete, you basically design the vehicles from their toolbox to complete these challenges.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's I could ramble on about that for a while. But yeah, Viva Pinata was a great example. And it's also, I think, a good example of how you can have some kind of persistent goal when your game is completely open-ended, when there's not supposed to be a endpoint or a final thing to achieve. You just keep giving the player these tiny little goalposts to aim for, or carrots on the sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, and I you know, I find that when they're well done, they add a lot of fun to the game. You know, they're not they're not arbitrary. I'm playing a mobile game right now, Alto's Adventure, and it's it's another endless runner, really well presented, really great great visuals. And I just find myself, you know, they've got 51 levels of objectives, you know, and and I just find myself, you know, just, I'm going to do it. I'm going to unlock that next, you know, that's every 10 objective, every 10 levels you raise, you unlock a new character, and they have slightly different skills on their snowboards, you know? and it's just one of those silly, you know, things that I'm like, man, I'm still having fun, you know, I'm 40 levels in and I'm still having fun. And so, you know, that's great. Like, I feel like, there's no shame in that as a designer, as a developer, you know, like a lot of kind of the content driven, maybe more of like a big game mindset, you know, sort of produce big areas and lots of high quality content that you sort of play through once. And indies don't really have that luxury. Like, we can't create, you know, a block of downtown San Francisco for you to go and have one mission in, you know, we just can't do that. but I think in some ways that has forced us to go back and think about gameplay, you know, and how can we make gameplay that's just as fun as that mission in downtown San Francisco, but uses less content and a smaller team. And I think that's great. I think it's phenomenal and in some ways sort of brings out the best parts of gaming.
Yeah, definitely about it needs to be able to do more with less. We've seen so many examples. The one that I'm playing right now at the time of this recording will probably be Desktop Dungeons, which is it's a 8-bit looking game, very simplistic, but it is one of the hardest effing games I've played in a long time.
You know, that's another one that's come up. Another one I haven't played, kind of embarrassed to say. I have it on my, you know, I actually bought it, but I haven't played it yet because, sometimes making games keeps you from playing games, which is a bummer. But
and for someone who writes a lot about games, I've learned that my time of playing them has also decreased. I mean, it definitely takes a lot of time to do this stuff, and that's another really good point about games like Race to Sun, or what it sounds like with Hexcard, is that it's a game that you can basically, it's not a game that you're forced to sit for an hour, 2 hour chunk to enjoy. You can play for 5-10 minutes, and that is something that we see a lot in very popular games these days, that yes, the game may have 10, 20, 30 hours of content, but you can get a good experience of the game within 5-10 minutes, and then you're just playing 5-10 minutes here, 5-10 minutes there, and so on and so on, and the time just adds up. And the classic example I turn to would be The Binding of Isaac, which a typical run maybe lasts 20-30 minutes, and I've easily gone over 100 hours playing that and the revised, I guess, pseudo sequel slash remake of it.
Yeah, totally. And I would consider that a maturation of games. You know, our lives are changing. Yes, we're more busy. Yes, gamers are kind of growing up and raising kids and having, you know, less opportunities to kind of sit down and play a game all afternoon. But at the same time, you know, you look at other art forms and how they've matured. You know, a book can be read. It is divided up into chapters generally. You know, if you're reading a novel, like there's a reason that those chapters exist. It gives people, you know, gives readers this natural stopping point so they can set the book down and come back to it later. Movies, you know, like there's a reason why they didn't make, you know, all of the Harry Potter books into one long, or Lord of the Rings. You know, I mean, there's a reason why they didn't make that a 12-hour movie that you sit and watch through the whole thing. Like that would not be as enjoyable as it is to kind of watch it in segments and chunks. And so I think that that's actually a maturation of the art form. And I personally know that I just don't have the opportunity to experience many games in, like, you know, sitting down and playing through several hours at once. It's just not there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me to enjoy a game, sometimes it has to be presented in smaller bites, and that's fine, you know. Figuring out how to present those smaller chunks in a way that's still impactful, you know, whether emotionally or giving people a challenge or whatever the game itself is trying to do. I think that, you know, that's a little more difficult, you know, if you know you have an hour or 2 hours to work with. I think you can kind of assume the state of the player is in a certain place after they've, you know, climbed this mountain or, you know, done whatever it happens to be for X amount of time. So you have to, you know, you have to be efficient and you have to know what you're doing as far as game design. And we're still new to this. So there are definitely people out there who have a better concept of that, but hopefully, you know, what we've learned in Race the Sun will carry over to our next game, and it will convey a lot and do a lot in a short amount of time and short amount of play session. So
awesome. Yeah, regarding pacing with games, I mean, that's another one of those major topics that there's just so much to go into about. I mean, TV shows are a good example of how we're seeing shows aim at 30-minute segments. We're even seeing some do like 15-minute chunks, hour, hour and a half, etc. And the art of getting the proper pacing is really challenging. You mentioned, of course, Harry Potter. And again, I mean, they could have made one movie out of three, four of those books. But the pacing would just be, it would be a completely different story, really, at that point.
Right. There was something that the author was doing. And, you know, it couldn't be conveyed in the same way, you know? And so, you know, and YouTube, it's kind of opened up in the film movie kind of regard, it's opened up a new way of presenting things there. So, I mean, there are, shows that I watch where the episodes are 5 minutes long. Like, that's a thing now. Like, I watch a show where a season, you know, they have 12 episodes a season and each episode is 5 minutes long. and it's fine. You know, like, it's a new way to experience it. And I find myself really kind of invested into these shows. And then I kind of step back and look like, wow, I've watched less than an hour of this show and I've watched an entire season, you know? But for storytellers who kind of embrace the format, they can do a lot in 5 minutes. An incredible amount of content can be jammed in there. So
yeah, especially what we're seeing with like custom shows on like Netflix and Hulu. I know the big one at the time of this podcast would be what they do with Daredevil on Netflix.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen any of that.
Yeah, but me neither, but yeah, that's on my list.
Been hearing all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. All right. I think with that, another great tangent we've had on this podcast, I think we're going to start to wrap things up. Again, Forrest, it's been a pleasure talking to you this afternoon. I think we could really just sit here and talk for another 2-3 hours. I think those are some of like the best podcasts we've had when it's just a great conversation.
Cool. Yeah, it's been a blast talking with you.
All right. So with that, I have a few final set of wrap-up questions for you, Forrest, and then we will say adieu for tonight.
Sounds good.
So the first one is, with Hexgarden, you said that you're planning on having something a little bit more concrete as we get more into the summertime. Do you have any idea right now as a possible release date, or is it still too much up in the air?
Still way up in the air right now. Okay. We're basically, you know, we're trying not to put artificial limits on ourselves too much. We have a, you know, a kind of a mantra of following the fun when it comes to games. Mm-hmm. So if we're onto something, we don't want to cut it short, you know. And so we're trying not to put hard limits on ourselves. But yeah, sometime, you know, probably later this year or earlier next year is kind of like the general time frame. So.
And when Hexcore is out, are you guys going to be shooting for Steam, GOG, and the other major digital sites?
Yeah. Steam for sure. We're developing it on, you know, kind of with PC controls right now, and those are coming together really good. But we're trying with our games to kind of go as wide as we can.
Yeah.
We feel like if we can convey, if the controls are good, you know, and, mm-hmm. and there are people to play the game, basically our two requirements, like if the game feels good on a platform and there are people there who would want to buy it, then then we'll go there. So that's kind of our thing. And we're bringing Race the Sun to Nintendo Wii U, and working on that, actually wrapping up development on that shortly here. Mm-hmm. And in a couple other platforms this year, so we're just going to try to go as wide as we can and you know, let as many people get their hands on it as possible.
All right. And now, did Race the Sun get to the mobile devices? Because I know that was one of your Kickstarter stretch goals.
Yeah, we didn't reach the stretch goal in the Kickstarter, but we are planning to bring it to iOS devices. So that's in the works as well, and we'll hopefully have you know, kind of a release date to announce soon. So
awesome. All right, with that, my final question then for you, Forrest, for tonight is, do you have any final thoughts on any of the topics we discussed or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening?
Oh man, yeah, it's been a great conversation. I you know, I just say, like, if you're a game player, I hesitate to say gamer, because I think, you know, just if you don't identify yourself as a gamer, that's fine. Like, mm-hmm. if you just play games on your mobile phone, that's cool. You know, mm-hmm. like you're a game player, and that's you play at whatever level you want to. You play the types of games you want to play. And that's what it's about. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to own like a, you know, a giant gaming PC and have, you know, whatever kind of setup or be a console person to be a, you know, a game player. So I would just say, if that's you out there, you know, just understand that, you know, the process of making games is hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of developers out there from indie and all the way up to AAA, like, they're trying to make great things. They really are. And sometimes they fall short, you know, so mm-hmm. like, be understanding, you know, like, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably get that, you know, cause you kind of get a behind the scenes, look at this, you know, that, you know, like adding that one feature that would just make the game awesome, you know, it's not that the developer hates you, you know, that's not why they're not adding that feature. It's probably because they can't afford to, you know, the time that it would take. So I see people getting angry out there over a lot of things. And for me, it's like, I feel like we just need a little bit more understanding. So that's kind of become part of the thing that I say. And also just, you know, that, my gosh, I mean, we have been supported and encouraged almost everywhere we turn, like the gaming community and the indie gaming community is awesome. You know, there's a lot of publicity given to the sort of the negative things that happen. But not enough talk about the awesome things that happen. And we have seen, just wonderful, beautiful things, all around. And so I'm sure that there are people out there who I have never thanked, you know, whether it was retweeting, you know, a sale that they may have thought was like nothing, but actually like was life or death for our business. Mm-hmm. You know, or people who have just put in a good word for us, or, you know, thumbs up our green light page. So I would just say thank you. Like, you know, you guys know who you are, and I probably have forgotten so many people along the way just because I've been too busy. But yeah, I guess that's it.
All right. Awesome. Okay, I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. Again, Forrest, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and definitely like to have you back on. Maybe we can have your brother on too at some, because I know in the email you said that he was very busy this week too.
Yes. We're crunching away at ports and the new game and all kinds of stuff. So so I decided. But yeah, it'd be great to come on and chat together. I've had a blast, and I'm sure that he'd love to be a part when we have a little more time. So
Awesome, and I can't wait to check out Hex Garden and see whatever you guys come up next with Race the Sun.
Very cool. We'll be in touch about that. So
awesome. So with that said, we're going to end things here for the Perceptive Podcast this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. For writing a guest piece on the site or being a future podcast guest, you can find all the information for that under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And for our continuing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding for the site, you can find that information under the Patreon banner also on the front page. And if you would like to watch daily Let's Plays as I play games and either get my ass kicked or succeed and talk more about the design, you can find that on Twitch under my handle of GWBicer, and I usually play daily around 9 or 10 Eastern Standard Time. So, with that all said, thanks again for tuning in, and I will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.